This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Not everyone who thinks there might be extraterrestrials out there is a kook. NASA will begin a search for extraterrestrial intelligence in 1992. My guest, Frank White, has written a new book about the scientific search for life beyond Earth. It's called The SETI Factor. SETI is an acronym for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. The book also speculates how our view of life on Earth would change if scientists did make contact with life on other planets. White is a senior associate at the Space Studies Institute in Princeton, New Jersey. He and Isaac Asimov co-authored the book The March of the Millennia. White believes that NASA's project is one of the most significant steps yet in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Having a major agency like NASA involved symbolically says this is a reasonable scientific effort. Public funds can be spent on it. It's worth doing. But at another level, it's significant because the biggest difference between this search and others is really in the computer equipment that's being used. They will be using existing radio telescopes, but they're creating a very complex new computer system that will be able to discriminate in a much more complete way the kinds of information that's coming from the galaxy to the radio telescope than in the past, so that they'll be able to look more carefully and more broadly at the kinds of signals that are coming in. There's a lot of noise, there's a lot of information that you can pick up if you point a radio telescope at the sky. The critical issue is, what is an artificial signal? How can you tell an artificial signal? And how can you look at enough frequencies to know that you've really done a good search? So the biggest difference really is in the power of the computing machinery. There is a fairly powerful search going on right now that's privately sponsored by the Planetary Society, and they have a site up here in Massachusetts, and they have another one down in South America. Again, the NASA search is going to be technologically more powerful. Also, it's going to be funded for something like 10 years. So the significance here is that if there is extraterrestrial intelligence, if they want to be in communication with us, within our lifetimes, we may well be in contact with them. So it's very significant that something might happen in the near future.
You raised the question before, how can transmission equipment or radio telescopes discriminate between random noise and pre-existing signals with intelligently made signals. So is this new computer equipment designed to discriminate?
Well, the equipment is going to be using a lot of sophisticated software so that it'll basically be programmed, and it'll say, if you see this kind of signal, ignore that, because that is just the galaxy making static. If you see the next kind of signal, ignore that. That's probably man-made, or it's probably human in origin. It's probably coming from Earth. And then there will be other formulas that will say, now, if you see this signal, call a human. Get a person to come look at this, because this is something that is apparently neither natural nor Earth originating. And the other key thing that hasn't been done by most searches in the past is this equipment will also have an ability to lock on, stay with a signal, and keep looking at it over a period of time. In the past, some of the searches have actually located signals that look like what the scientists were looking for, but when they went back and looked for it later, they couldn't find it. Or because of the way the equipment was set up, they couldn't go back for quite a while and look for it. So there have been some signals that have been detected which looked interesting, to put it mildly, but they didn't repeat. And this new equipment is going to have an ability to stay targeted on the signals for a longer period of time.
If a signal is detected and it's only detected once and it cannot be duplicated, it's never found again, is it dismissed? Or is there a certain number of times a signal has to be registered, received, before it's taken seriously as a possible message from intelligent life?
Well, the criterion that the scientists have set up is that it has to have a certain pattern, which is called a bold spike. And it's a wave that clearly stands out against the background of static and natural noise. So that's one criterion. And then the other one is, if you can't go back and pick it up later, the next day or whatever, it is dismissed in the sense of it's assumed that it is something that we can't explain, but it's not a signal that's aimed at us, and it's just called an anomaly. So it's an interesting question. I think basically the scientists feel that if it doesn't repeat, and if you have limited resources, there's no real value in going back and trying to figure out what these signals are. But they are a mystery. They're called anomalies, and I think that's a good word for them.
Frank White is my guest. He's an author, consultant, and a senior associate at the Space Studies Institute in Princeton. He's written several books on space exploration. His new book is called The SETI Factor, How the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence is Revolutionizing Our View of the Universe and Ourselves. There has actually been a protocol established for what to do if a signal is received. Who established the protocol? And then you can describe what it is for us.
Well, the protocol is a very interesting document because it is one of the first conscious efforts to deal with the impact of contact. It's the effort to bring some social science into what is mostly a physical scientific experiment. At some of the early conferences in the 80s, when people were first starting to talk about what would happen if we got a signal, they and some other people who were involved in the field decided there should be a procedure that all SETI researchers around the world would follow if you were sitting at your equipment and suddenly you were successful, you got something. Obviously, that would be an important moment, and the first thing you'd want to do would be to make sure it wasn't a false alarm. So the first thing you have to do, really, is get confirmation from other sites. Replicate the experiment. With the NASA project, they're also going to load new software in to make sure that at the next observing period, they have fresh software and what they were seeing wasn't being caused by the computer itself. There's been talk of setting up a contact verification committee. The idea here would be, even after you've gotten technological confirmation that you think there's something here, you'd have a group of experts sit down and say, yes, we really do believe this is a signal that is artificial in nature, it's coming from outside the planet Earth, and it's meaningful. Once you've gone through all of those processes, you begin to move toward an announcement phase. And the principle there is that they want to make the information available immediately. There's a lot of concern that the information not be suppressed, that people trust the information, that it come out from a credible source, and that it be seen as the property of humanity, not of any one nation.
Well, say we were to receive a signal that scientists really believed was coming from intelligent life in another galaxy or in outer space somewhere. What possibilities would there be of communicating with that life? Would there be any chance of doing that, or would that just be a signal, we'd register it, there'd be news about it, and we'd all then nothing?
Well, one of the things I tried to think about in this book was, in terms of the impact on us, don't we have to think about where is the signal coming from and what is the nature of the signal, which is really the question you're asking. For example, maybe it's just a signal, and it has no information content to it. Well, what do we learn from that? We learn a lot. We learn that we're not alone in the universe as an intelligent species. There's another one out there. They're not saying much to us, but they're sending us a message that they're there. We know where they are. We can tell how far away they are. And probably we would anticipate hearing more from them. On the other hand, the situation changes very dramatically if there's a lot of information. What if there's a signal that says, stand by. We will now transmit all the knowledge that our planet possesses. This would be dramatically different. So volume of information is pretty important. The other question about dialogue has to do with how far away are they. NASA's going to be looking at 1,000 stars within 100 light years of us. That means some of these planets could be within 5 or 10 light years, which means it would take that long for us to send a message back. It would take that long for them to respond. So the dialogue would be a bit slow, but at least it would be possible. I mean, we could get a message from a star system 25,000 or 100,000 light years away, and within our lifetime, we could never communicate with them. So all impact won't be the same. It will really depend on the nature of the signal, how far away they are. It's also going to depend on how soon we receive it. The more prepared we are for it, the better we'll be able to conduct a dialogue. For example, if it happened tomorrow, I would say we're really not ready.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and the acronym for that search is SETI. My guest is Frank White, author of the new book, The SETI Factor. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Frank White. He's a senior associate at the Space Studies Institute in Princeton, author of several books on space exploration, including the latest, The SETI Factor. Scientists are pretty divided over our chances of actually finding intelligent life out in space. I mean, they're divided over the possibility of the existence of intelligent life. Let's talk a little bit about both sides of that argument. On one side is the theory that's become known as the assumption of mediocrity.
Yeah, this is, I have said before, I think that's a poor name for it because it doesn't quite communicate what's being said. But what they're trying to say is evolution happens much the same way everywhere in the universe, far as we can tell. So what we see happening on Earth, if you have another planet, anything like Earth, you should see the same scenario. Therefore, you should expect an Earth-like planet to produce intelligent life like ourselves. That's the assumption of mediocrity. The Sun is a very ordinary star. There are literally billions of Sun-like stars in our galaxy alone, and there are billions of galaxies. So the assumption of mediocrity really argues from the numbers that are available to us that life is probably very abundant, so is intelligent life, and so contact is at least a reasonable possibility. It's interesting, this is a scientific theory that's enunciated by people like Carl Sagan, but actually, Terry, I think most people I've talked to who know nothing about the subject start from that assumption. They just start from the fact that, hey, there are so many stars out there. There must be planets. If there are planets, there must be life and intelligence, and it's very arrogant of us to think we're the only ones.
And what's the principle that argues the other side?
Well, that's the cosmic anthropological theory. Basically, that argument says, no, there's nothing in the numbers to indicate that life is abundant or intelligence is abundant. They point out quite forcefully that we don't really know if there are planets around other stars yet. Therefore, we don't know how many planets a star would have, and we don't know whether life would necessarily be a frequent appearance on these planets or not. They also point out that going from life to intelligence is quite a leap that we don't totally understand yet. We're not sure why it happens. We're not sure why it happened in our case. So their argument is, hey, it might take an entire galaxy worth of material to produce one species like humanity. And the other argument they make, which is interesting, is that if intelligent life had developed elsewhere, they would be here. They would have sent probes. they would have in some way made their presence known. And I have to say, on my own part, these two arguments are both logical in their own way. And before I started writing the book, I was really a proponent of the assumption of mediocrity. I just assumed that the galaxy and the universe were probably populated by civilizations. But after reading more about the other school of thought, I could see that their arguments were awfully cogent as well.
Are there any other compelling arguments, pro or con, that you know of?
Well, there is a kind of a middle ground between the two, and there might be life flourishing in many planets, but that would not necessarily mean that there would be intelligent life. And moreover, you could have intelligent life that would never reach the point where it would start communicating with us. Moreover, you might have intelligent life that would reach the kind of high technological phase we're in. They would be able to communicate, but through nuclear disaster or ecological collapse, two things that we face, those civilizations might disappear. So there's another argument that says, well, somewhere in between cosmic anthropological principle and the assumption of mediocrity, there is this idea that some civilizations might even have gotten started and eventually destroyed themselves, or they might have chosen not to go down the path that we've gone. They might not really have any interest in communicating with us. And so that's a kind of a middle ground.
My guest is Frank White, and he's an author, consultant, and a senior associate at the Space Studies Institute in Princeton. He's the author of several books about space exploration, and his latest is called The SETI Factor. SETI is an acronym for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Isn't it possible that if there really was extraterrestrial intelligence out there that we wouldn't recognize it because it would look nothing like life as we know it?
This is an insight that I think a lot of people have had, and it's why I've said that we aren't really searching for extraterrestrial intelligence, but we're really searching for extraterrestrial intelligence like ourselves. We're assuming life arises on planets exclusively. We're assuming that intelligence should be defined by having big brains like ours, that it is packaged, let us say, in the way that we are. And of course, these are assumptions based on one case. Some people have pointed out that it's quite possible that intelligence could be embodied in swarms of microorganisms that are floating between the stars and have learned to live in free space. Some people have suggested that planets may have a form of intelligence. I mean, we're just now beginning to look at the Earth as a living organism. So, yeah, my view, having gone through this process of thinking about it, is I really think there is extraterrestrial intelligence. I think the question exactly is, what is its packaging?
Are Earthlings beaming any kind of information to outer space so that if there is intelligent life there, they could find our signals and discover us? So we're expecting intelligent life to be beaming messages to us.
Yeah. Well, in terms of intentional messages, one of the outcomes of the protocol movement has been that people have realized that we really have an ethical question of who has the right to do that kind of communication. And people have concluded that if we got a message, we don't really have an international body that's authorized to respond. But similarly, we really don't have anyone authorized to speak for Earth by sending information out there. Now, there was an experiment done where a message was sent to a region 25,000 light years from here. It was sent by one of the more powerful radio telescopes. And the feeling there was that it was going to a region so far away it couldn't do any harm. Also, one of the Voyager spacecraft has a message on it. That is to say, it's a CD disc that has greetings from people on Earth, songs, some representation of what life on Earth is about, and a drawing showing where we are and what we look like. But basically, I think it makes sense, there's been kind of a conservative approach to announcing our presence. One final point, though, is that all the radio and television signals, including this show, are radiating out from the Earth, out into the galaxy. And one of the reasons people are kind of optimistic that the extraterrestrials might contact us is that some of those programs have now reached stars 10, 20, 30, 40 light years away. So it may be known, if there are civilizations out there, they may well know that we exist, and they may know a lot about us. They can watch our news shows, they can listen to our radio programs, they could study our culture pretty completely.
I hope they get better reception than we get in Center City.
Yeah, I hope so.
A lot of people wonder, with homelessness the way it is in America today, with poverty the way it is in America, how can you justify spending a lot of money searching for extraterrestrial intelligence? How would you justify it?
Well, I think that question can be applied to the space program as a whole. And I guess what I've concluded is that society always invests a certain amount of its resources in learning more about the nature of the universe and the nature of our planet and the nature of ourselves. And that's always worthwhile, because in many instances, without being able to predict how it will help life on Earth, it turns out that it does. And you have to have an exploring society, I think, an expansive society that's interested in more than what's immediately before it, to really be creative enough to solve problems like homelessness and poverty. So my answer is that I don't think we should spend so much money on space exploration that we don't deal with these problems, but that it's reasonable to invest a small amount. And a key thing about SETI is that this NASA project is only going to be about $100 million over a 10-year period. So compared to a lot of other programs, it's really relatively inexpensive. And the results, I mean, we really haven't talked about this, but think about if we were able to begin communication with a society that's, say, a few hundred years in advance of us, or 1,000 years, we may be able to make quantum leaps in our understanding of medical issues, organizing our society. We really don't know what it would be like to have that kind of influx of new information, but the payoff could be enormous.
Frank White, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Frank White is the author of The SETI Factor. Next time, the Jerusalem Bureau Chief of the New York Times, Joel Brinkley. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.